Good afternoon, everyone. Happy Friday. And I'm very delighted to see so many people in our assertive engagement techniques and strategies for successful rapport building training. I'm joined with my colleague, Chelsea. My name is, again, Larry Fernandez, LCSW, and I've been a part of this wonderful UCLA Public Mental Health Partnership for a few years now, 2 years, a little bit of change, and come with a history of overseeing a few FSP programs and from the directorship side. So today, Chelsea and I will be working on kind of sharing some of our knowledge conjointly on assertive engagement. And so with that said, I'm going to take us into on the starting point to go over some of the overview and kind of the focus, if you will, of this training. And without any further ado, we're going to jump right into our learning objectives. And so again, although there may be other things that you will take from this that are probably informal and probably information that's shared by way of dialogue and feedback from others, the three main learning objectives are to distinguish four persistent engagement strategies that can be used to strengthen rapport with difficult to engage clients, which we are all familiar with working in an FSP space or something similar. Secondly, describe three informal engagement methods that can be used during the outreach to build therapeutic alliance, strengthen our relationships with the client, and then really just build an ongoing experience mutually for both the provider and the client to have the best outcome possible in treatment. And then lastly, to illustrate how, when, and why informal engagement strategies are essential in developing client treatment plans within at least one current client example, and really how to keep the client engaged and also make sure that they are part of this entire process that we call rapport building, treatment recovery, and the successful outcome, and making sure that the clients are very much part of that. So thank you. So first we'll start with just a general definition of what engagement is before we get into our next level of engagement, which is assertive, right? Again, just engagement in itself is where participants first, where participants get their first impression, right? Much like any other relationship you built with someone that you meet for the first time, it's really first impression based, right? So that first impression is very, very important in terms of how someone, connects with you by way of everything from visual to physical energy to feeling like they are being supportive in nature by way of just maybe something you might have in common. And then again, the second thing is just a process. And keeping in mind that engagement, much like a friendship or a legal connection that you're developing, is a process, right? And it's something that you're going to continue to build blocks onto, and it's not a one-time thing. Again, when we meet someone and establish a working relationship with someone, like, again, a coworker, it's not like we meet them for the first time, and then from there, we never talk about anything else but work, right? It's an event in itself where we introduce the service relationship, explain our role, and find common ground. And then it's highly individualized. Again, just imagine if you met everyone in your life the same way, used the same language, had the same approach. Again, that would be not only kind of a bit boring, but it probably would exclude a lot of folks in your life that may have not otherwise connected with you. Again, just think about the times that you met someone and you're like, hey, I remember first meeting this person and I had a different impression. And now it's like totally different again. So with that, just keep that in mind as we talk about engagement and we move on to our next slide, which is our understanding of assertive engagement. And that, just by way of definition, is really untreated mental health or co-occurring disorders that can be influenced building a relationship, I should say, with untreated folks who are having either a mental health challenge, a mental health illness, defined, also co-occurring, and then we're establishing this relationship over a length of time. Again, building therapeutic relationships, building a trust, establishing knowledge about that client, allowing them to be the experts in their space. Assertive engagement involves the use of interpersonal skills, such as, you know, being very attentive, being interested in someone's experience, and also subsequent care that they may need. It's not just what we need or what we are here to provide for them, right? But also understanding that a client may have a variety of needs. And so if we're looking at developing an assertive experience of engagement, knowing that we may have to also tread through some of those experiences with the client. Again, it entails taking multidisciplinary services directly to people in places like encampments, streets, sidewalks, alleyway school, public spaces, followed by the provision of ongoing support. So again, and I'm sure many of you have heard that whatever it takes phrase, and of course, and that's what we mean more than not, we're going to find ourselves in places that we probably otherwise didn't imagine when we were, maybe doing some training or formal grad school or whatever the case may be of where we would be interviewing someone. So again, something to think about in terms of the definition of assertive engagement and how it really necessitates an open mind and a lot of flexibility. And as we talk about assertive engagement, there are goals to assertive engagement. And although there can be very specific goals that you can add on to this short list here, you know, that are created by your team, your leadership team, here are a few that are going to allow for us to have a commonality by way of who's in this training today. And what we want to really focus on by way of those strategies. The first one is establishing a relationship, which is primary, right? And again, knowing that a relationship being built, sometimes we are lucky enough that one contact, one initial interview or 30-minute conversation blossoms into a really healthy, quick relationship that becomes open and gives us all the opportunity to share the treatment needs with the client. But again, sometimes it may take months and sometimes longer. And so just knowing that this component here, step one, is very important, because without successfully going through this step one, there is no step two, right? And so care for the participant's immediate needs, and just, again, keeping in mind Maslow's hierarchy of basic needs, right? As we are focused on building a relationship, think about ourselves, what are our basic needs, right? And why it's important for us to be mindful of a client's basic needs. Because here's an example. I mean, if we are there to try to provide and offer mental health services, but the client has nowhere to live, has not eaten for many days, is not feeling safe in the community or in the space that they're currently in. Those things can outweigh the relationship that we're trying to offer and the services of mental health, because primary on the mind for that individual might be, when am I going to eat? How am I going to eat? Who's, can I get someone to help me in these current situation I'm in, where I'm feeling fearful or unsafe. And so as we think about that in step two, is really being mindful to this hierarchy of basic needs and knowing that until we get those out of the way, we can't move on to the next part, which is administering services. And again, part of this goal of assertive engagement is understanding the service administration piece here of when we're going to do services, how we're going to do it, and we're going to do it at the pace of a client, and not at the pace of what we would desire to do it on. And then connecting to resources and providing education. And again, knowing that we may have an array of connections, an array of service resources that we can say to the client, hey, here's 50 resources. But the client may not want those. The client may just want something completely different, and know that the goal of assertive engagement is to connect somebody to the resources they currently want, and establish that experience by way of providing also psychoeducation about what their additional needs might be. And then lastly, in this goals category here, is working on developing stability of basic needs, and knowing that it's not about helping someone, you know, not feel unsafe one time, or housing somebody temporary, is really to build an experience of stability long term. And so as we establish that assertive engagement, also making sure that we're mindful of how we share information, what words we use, be very selective so that we're not promising something that later we cannot provide and then damages all these five steps that we've put energy into. And here we have these three really unique areas of assertive engagement, which I really love. Again, as we look at these three areas of engagement, maybe a little bit non-traditional for some of us as we see these areas of assertive engagement broken down into three areas as such, but keeping in a very separate kind of category, if you will, by way of first mindset, then skill set, and then heart set. So I'm going to start with mindset, and it's really equaling to how we think about the people we work with, right? I mean, what is our mindset? Are we seeing them as important individuals? Are we seeing them as priorities? Are we seeing them as someone who necessitates all our energy and our focus? Or are we just seeing a client as someone that we just have to do a routine effort for? And again, this is really the emphasis of establishing individuality and care for a client. And so this is one area that it is very important to consider as we look at the next piece there of skill set, which how do we do this work, right? And it really equals to like, what are the capabilities that we have? Are we effectively trained? Do we have the appropriate support? And what is needed individually for one of your team members or yourself to be able to provide supervision for someone who's constantly doing this kind of work, because it can be very heavy. And then the last part, which I really like, is the heart set, which equals how we feel how we feel about and how we treat the people we work with. So are we really valuing their opinions, their information, their desired outcomes, even though it may not be something that we would probably want for ourselves and want to maybe put it in a priority category for our own life, but can we respect that? Can we be prepared to provide services nonetheless without any specific bias and just being ready by way of heart set? And as we talk about heart set, is really when you're going out to see that client, are you really in the right mindset? Are you ready? Has everything else in your day been allowed to fit itself in properly so that you can give all the energy and focus to here? Or are you still worried about the last case? Or are you more focused on making sure that you're documenting that you're going out? And just, again, making sure that all efforts and energy are focused on our client. All right, so as we're looking at this wonderful slide here, now, you know, again, a couple of bubbles that are very close to one another in many respects are just kind of carrying over to proximity. And then we see a bunch of different aspects. So it's a nice visual to first and foremost kind of prompt us to the question is, what is important to the client during engagement? Again, as you know, we look at to your left and kind of the teal green color, you know, we want to ask ourselves not only what is important to the client, but ask the client directly, what has the client really, you know, experienced in the past? What's important for them currently? And why is it important for them at this moment? So again, that really comes down to acknowledging their expertise of their own life. And being okay with that, you know, we can be, again, the professionals in the mental health space, substance abuse space, case management space, and that's fine. But we want to make sure that we acknowledge as valuable as the information that we have gained, that the information the clients have about their own lives is extremely valuable. And they are in many respects experts of that. And so we want to honor it and be very respectful of the fact that we are also learning from the clients in this process of engagement. And make sure you share that information. And again, as we look over to the next green color to your right, we see client-directed treatment, making sure that whatever treatment experiences are taking place, that they are really the voice and choice of the client. Again, very much honoring that, the client is able to drive treatment, be part of it, be the decision maker. And how you do that is checking in with the client regularly. Again, just because the client may have said something verbatim and we took that information and put it on paper, doesn't mean that their minds don't change in a week, 2 weeks. It's really about checking in consistently and regularly about, are we still focused on the same thing? I noticed you're not as available today. Are you okay? Are things going on differently than, last week? Again, more times than not, there's a reason why somebody either discontinues to come to treatment, drops off of treatment, or finds themselves further apart from your team. And it's very important that we be mindful of that and respectful of it. Again, the one thing that we have to keep in mind, that opening ourselves up is a vulnerable thing by way of therapeutics. And that alone in itself can get someone to say, I feel a bit of shame or embarrassment. I don't want to, see this person. Again, I just shared a lot of things that can be very, very embarrassing for me to have to engage in conversation about. And so, thinking that, the client is directing treatment and making them aware of that process. And again, literally, and in our next bubble, we said, we read here, it says literally meeting them where they're at. So again, where are you? Where would you like to meet? Where are you most comfortable meeting? You're unfortunately unhoused. Is there a particular space in which you tend to feel comfortable? Is there two main streets that maybe we could meet at? Is there a place nearby there? And just, again, giving the client that comfortability to meet in a place where they're at. This will ultimately not only emphasize that a client is important, but also allow for the client to direct treatment, as we're mentioning. And then unconditional positive support, that regardless of what the client is choosing and their decision-making processes and how they engage in treatment, it's just being, genuine, being supportive, being aware, and even, with things like how we respond, how we react, our body language, our facial features, and just making sure that we're often in the space of being able to demonstrate unconditional positive regard, whether it's verbally or non-verbally. And that could say a lot. I mean, I will say I have been asked if I'm mad, and I'm not mad. And sometimes maybe my facial features may say that. And so I want to check in with folks about, hey, are we okay? And so again, just doing that to make sure that we are establishing a firm foundation of openness with our client. And with that said, is acknowledge their expertise, as mentioned a second ago, that we are definitely going to learn a lot about our clients and really individualize them as the entity of value that they are. I'm going to hand the mic over to Chelsea to take us through the engagement barriers.
Thanks, Larry. So I'm going to start with barriers, but we're going to end with what we can do. So I know that talking about barriers and challenges can feel, kind of brings the energy down. But we want to talk about them because, it sounds simple. Engage with people, be creative, try to find some common ground, but then you keep adding on unconditional positive regard and meeting them where they're at and containing our own emotions when things are they're doing maybe evoke something in us. And so it's complicated, right? There's a lot going on when we're engaging with our clients, women coming out of the prison system, you know, folks going in and out of hospitalization, housing, there's so much going on. So what we're going to do now is talk about what gets in the way of engagement from a couple different kind of viewpoints. So first, we have this graphic here, which has like a person in the middle. And if you look at the red boxes, those are kind of like the barriers that providers, us as providers, or whatever title you might have, whatever your role is, a support person, those are things that impact us and can be barriers to engagement. And then the blue ones are things that can impact the client directly. And then impact our like relationship building with them. We know that both we and our clients bring our unique histories with us whenever we're engaging together. Issues you face, issues they've faced, things you face together, you know, systemic issues that you both have to wrestle with because of your work and their livelihood. And these can get in the way. So let's talk about the different ones here. So we'll start with providers, the red boxes. We've got meeting inconsistently. So when we're meeting inconsistently with either in our own workspaces, you know, not having enough communication between the multidisciplinary team about what's going on with the client, then things can be missed. And that could lead to a poor engagement because not everyone knows what's going on. But if you're also not able to meet with a client consistently because you have other things going on, it's hard with time management. You have like a caseload, there's crises every week. You know, meeting inconsistently, that can make engagement difficult because clients don't know when they can count on you, right? And that erodes trust, even though sometimes this is out of our control. And then another thing out of our control is staff turnover, right? We don't have control over whether staff stay or go. I mean, we can contribute to a positive working environment and that can help. However, people have reasons for leaving. And so this can impact us because then our caseloads can get bigger. We might have to be on call for crises more often. There's just not enough time for anything, right? So you can see how those get in the way of engagement, the best, like effective engagement with our client. Now this combined with what the client has gone through in their life, we've got trauma history, right? If you have done this work for, you know, more than a week, you know that there's a lot of trauma going on for the vast majority of our clients, either ongoing trauma based on living in the streets, being around violence, you know, childhood trauma, trauma from a few years ago. Like there's a lot going on that really contributes to how people respond to different things. And we'll talk more about that in a little bit when we talk about what we can do. But we gotta think about that. There's also substance use. When people are suffering, they turn to things that help them to cope and feel better in the short term. And substances have been useful for a lot of people in that way. However, we know that short-term substance use feels really helpful and long-term substance use, depending on how folks are using, what they're using, can be risky, it can be dangerous, and it can be fatal. So we've got to balance that as well. It can be also difficult to engage with someone who is intoxicated. And at the same time, we don't always have the luxury of waiting till our client is not intoxicated. They might be dependent. And so there's not really an opportunity to meet with them when they're not intoxicated. So what do we do? You know, that's another barrier. Mental health history can be a barrier, particularly treatment folks have gone through for mental health challenges. They may have had poor experiences with previous providers in different settings. You know, involuntary hospitalizations can be traumatic and can contribute to how people people feel about accepting services from someone new. You know, they've had a social worker, a caseworker, a person before who let them down. That really impacts how our engagement is going to go. Medical challenges can get in the way. People, particularly if folks have a serious mental illness and a physical issue at the same time, it can be really challenging to take care of that physical issue. You know, getting to the doctor, staying on your meds, getting the surgery, whatever is needed can be difficult. And so that can also be a challenge in engagement, because how can you do these other things if these medical challenges are in the way, right? If they can't move very well, if they have a risk of infection from wounds, things like that can get in the way of being able to reach a client's goals. Past experiences and then culture, super important. You know, we all have different experiences of culture. We all identify with different cultures. And, you know, those might, you might not know much about the culture of your client. They might make assumptions of you based on the culture they think you are a part of, and vice versa. And so all these biases can come into it, and that can be challenging for engagement. However, that doesn't mean it's impossible at all. These are just the things to keep in mind that can get in the way. And then we'll talk about in a bit what we're going to do about those barriers. So here are some that didn't fit so well in those buckets, but some additional challenges that can come up in engagement is, you know, time, having enough time for all of your client needs, all of your clients' needs, right? Because we have to balance all of the priorities of our caseload. So kind of combines like the culture and other components of the barriers that clients or customers can face. You know, people might not have trust in the mental health arena or even just the medical space because of, you know, there's so much evidence of people being harmed who were from non-dominant identities, right? And so having a like mistrust of people in these positions makes so much sense given that reality. Cognitive impairment can be really, really challenging to engagement because it's hard to know if you're on the same page when someone is having a hard time really communicating or understanding what you're saying. Intoxication, we talked about that. Attention span, you know, folks might kind of go here and there and not be able to focus really focus during a particular situation. I'm just thinking of all the clients I took to appointments and it was really hard for them to stay in one place for very long. Demands of other systems that require change rather than motivating. So for instance, the first thing I think of is housing that requires a negative urinalysis for substances, right? So, you know, it's not very motivating necessarily if someone is dependent on substances that they should just stop altogether. That's a huge ask. And evidence shows that it's not very successful for most people. So that can get in the way. Personal biases, right? How clients might feel about some identity that you have, how you might feel about something a client is going through that has to do with maybe an unchecked bias you have. There are a lot of biases around mental illness, around substance use, around being unhoused, right? They're all over the media. And so it's easy to buy into those. So trying to fight that and see our clients as full human beings with all the strengths and complications that we all have is really helpful. Another barrier to engagement and maybe to feeling that you are effective? Is this immediate needs being a priority? Often we can really easily identify all the problems and challenges that a client is experiencing, right? And we want to solve them all, right? We want them to get off all the substances, take their medication, quit smoking, you know, get more exercise, sleep all night, be safe, all these things. And we can't do all those at one time. If, you know, you probably know that change happens in tiny bite-sized pieces, and you just got to keep going with those little tiny things. So, when we are looking at the full spectrum, you know, we might get distracted by like long-term goals, but the immediate needs being a priority can be a bit challenging, but definitely deserves our focus. Finally, ambiguity and ambivalence can be challenges, both for you and for the client. So not having kind of being on the fence about what one should do, or maybe giving suggestions that are vague and not concrete for a client, that can get in the way. And then finally, conversation style. So the way Larry was mentioning, we speak to our clients, we treating them with, if we are kind of directing and telling people what to do, often does not feel as engaging and motivating as when someone is interested in what you want and kind of evokes your own creativity and values.
Yeah, Chelsea, if I can just add to
that
list about something that popped into my mind with possible barriers. And these are kind of systemic, sometimes macro barriers that are not often calculated within that category, right? And one of them is the provider agency perceived or historical definition of what successful engagement is, and, you know, or treatment. And so giving the impression to a team member that if, you know, you didn't meet with someone for an X amount of time, that it wasn't a successful outcome. Or if you were not able to accomplish a particular focus of a goal or part of a goal, that the time you spent was either less than or not effective. And so really, you know, as we see the evolution of intensive mental health treatment, is that every step is as valuable as the next, regardless how big or how small. And then, you know, in addition to that is the perception again of the productivity focus, you know, of needing to have a lengthy session so that it can then translate into productivity per se, and understanding that the aspect of engagement in itself is very valuable and very powerful, that will then allow for us to one day see the client for you know, a lengthier time. So two things that jump out at me that are non-traditional.
Great. Thanks, Larry. All right. So additional areas to avoid. So this has to do with how we're talking to our clients. So I usually go like this to mean pretty much a lot of these things. And it's something that we might want to do, but it is not effective. Like evidence has shown that people do not respond well, and it's not really supportive of our goals or their goals, or hopefully our shared goals. So in communicating with our clients, we want to be client-centered, and we really want to instill trust in our client that we're committed to meeting them where they're at and listening to both their needs and their wants, like what they need, but also what they prefer, right? Highlighting choices can be really empowering. So to do so, we need to be careful about how we communicate, noting when our communication shifts into one of these styles. Often this is due to our own thoughts and emotions that are evoked by the client's personality, by their situation, by the choices they're making, their behavior. This might make us feel extremely worried, anxious, or even angry, resentful. We have all kinds of emotional reactions to our clients, even if we don't respond, you know, we want to like deal with those before we respond. So we feel these emotions when clients are not making choices we feel they should make, or when they don't prioritize issues that we find alarming, because we're worried, we care, right? So the key here is to learn how to cope with our own emotions and shift our action and communication away from being reactionary to our own internal experience, like trying to grasp for control, and instead respond intentionally and with respect for our clients' autonomy. They're like, they get to call the shots in their life, right? And so when we are just like acting and kind of vibing on our own emotional response, we might be tempted to direct or command, you should do this, you should do that. We might do things like being coercive, bargaining, warning, or threatening. If you don't go to this appointment, then, you know, I can't think of what the threat would be, but, you know, or trying to sway, threatening, warning, kind of making it overemphasizing that they should do it without helping them understand what their options are and that they are in power, in control. This can also look like giving advice or unsolicited solutions to a problem area. I really dislike unsolicited advice in general. So I really try not to give it out because it has this feeling of, oh, you know better than me. Like I'm the expert in my life. Who are you to, you know, give me this advice I didn't even ask for? I just want some food stamps, right? So we're really trying to listen to what's important to them and meet them there. We don't want to be lecturing or arguing. If you are arguing with a client about a decision they're going to make, chances are they're not going to make the decision you want, right? Because you guys are not getting along. That engagement has been messed up. So it really doesn't lead to where we really feel like it should while we're in this reactionary stance of lecturing or arguing. Moralizing, preaching, or telling clients what they should do. You should remove it from your vocabulary. Just kidding. I said that and then I shouldn't have said should. There it is again. But we don't want to use should, right? It's not motivating. It feels patronizing. We also don't want to be disagreeing, judging, criticizing, or blaming. Again, when a client's on the receiving end of this, how more likely are they to engage in a different behavior, right? Even me, if someone is doing this, I just want to dig into whatever I'm doing, even if I don't like it, because who are you to tell me this? Disagreeing, judging, criticizing, or blaming, we don't want to do those things. Praising only the results and not the effort. So, you know, we'll come back to this point a lot, but change happens through micro changes that add up, right? So only praising the results and not the effort, you really miss all those juicy, you know, like strengths and efforts that your client has engaged in, or you have as well. We can give ourselves our own credit because sometimes we have to break it down and celebrate the tiny victories ourselves to keep momentum going. We never want to be shaming, ridiculing, or labeling. Labeling has to do with using words to describe people that are dehumanizing, right? Like using a diagnosis is one that comes to mind. We aren't consoling or sympathizing. Sympathizing is very different from empathizing. There's more distance between you and the client, like, oh, poor you. That's not as helpful as I can see this is really hard for you, right? There's on one hand, you're kind of standing away from the person and saying, oh yeah, that sucks. But in the other one, you're kind of getting in there with it and showing them that you understand. And then finally, withdrawing, humoring, or changing the subject. So avoiding what is you're talking about, avoiding the challenge. These can all not help engagement. So what can? Well, we've got some evidence-based tools for engagement that I'm going to talk about. I think we have five of them, maybe four, I can't remember. But the first one, so these are all different kind of modalities or strategies that evidence has shown helps engagement. So the first, none of these will be very surprising to you unless you're new. And then I encourage you to look into these things. We have trainings on, I think, pretty much all of these evidence-based practices. So first, we've got motivational interviewing. MI is a great technique known for helping a client build and strengthen motivation. We consider a client to be ambivalent when they're on the fence between two actions, and we help them uncover their own reasons for making a change, reinforcing the importance they give the change, as well as their sense of agency in embarking on the change. So we're helping them uncover why they want to change, highlighting how important that is to them, and then also helping them come up with ways to engage in change at a pace that feels good for them to do. What is different about MI from other approaches that are can be considered coercive or externally driven is that the focus is really on the client's values, beliefs, and wishes versus an external kind of reward or something. We're really trying to match the action to where the client is in their motivation to grow it slowly. A benefit of motivational interviewing when it comes to engagement is that it's a great tool to enhance your ability to listen effectively to your clients and reflect that understanding of their concerns, of what's important to them, their values, what they wish for their life, their dreams and goals. And this can help you remain in the stance of the client being the expert, which is helpful in preventing communication approaches that can distance you from the client. So when we get really good at listening, we are much less likely to do the things from the previous slide, directing, shaming, coercing, all these things. When we get more in touch with what's going on with the client, what's important to the client, how the client sees this happening, we're on the same team with them, and we're less likely to try to distance ourselves by lecturing or shoulding or any of those things I was talking about before. So if you're interested in motivational interviewing, I think it's wonderful for anybody who is working in kind of the mental health supportive realm, because it can be used in brief interactions, and it is, the listening skills are really great. There's an acronym. It's not PACE, that's the spirit of MI, ORS. So it has to do with like open-ended questions, affirmations, reflections. It's great. If you'd like to know more, let us know. We can give you links to trainings on MI in the chat. Another approach that is really helpful for engagement is harm reduction. So harm reduction can be used in for a variety of different behaviors that have some element of risk to them. Most often it's talked about in terms of substance use. And so that's what we'll kind of how I'll frame it for now as we talk about it. So when we're using harm reduction approaches, we're attempting to reduce the harm reduction, or adverse consequences of drug use or substance use. So it can include alcohol, without an expectation that a client quits, ceases, gets sober, whatever we want to call it. We're not looking for abstinence. We're not expecting that when we're using harm reduction. Harm reduction kind of came to be in response to these zero tolerance policies for substance use that have been largely ineffective in the long term for folks who use substances. It became clear that abstaining entirely from substances was an unrealistic goal for many substance users. However, people remained concerned about the risks of disease transmission, overdose, and death. So when we're doing harm reduction, we are trying to reduce the harm without trying to eliminate the use. We're not focused on eliminating or even necessarily reducing. That can be a goal of harm reduction. Instead, what we're trying to do is help people survive, really. It's reducing harm but it really could be simplified as survival. The goals are short-term and achievable. Harm reduction supports assertive engagement because it doesn't prevent us from working with folks who are actively using substances. When I got into this work, I thought, I was naive. I thought, oh, I could work with, I don't want to deal with substance use. I've had like family history stuff that makes me avoid it. And then I got in this work. I'm like, I was humbled quite quickly. I had to learn how to deal with my own feelings about substances, my own ideas about how to like deal with it that were informed by, not evidence or anything, just anecdotal training you get from society and your family. So harm reduction is really awesome because it's, there's this dichotomy in substance use of you're using or you're not using, but harm reduction goes to all the people in the middle, right? Who can still use additional safety, can use additional methods to continue to live and prevent overdose, prevent death, right? So what harm reduction does is it opens up options, allowing for creativity. And it shows that we care about a client's well-being and their safety while respecting their autonomy to choose what feels best to them. And that can be substances. Examples of harm reduction methods include linking clients to resources, such as syringe exchange, syringe exchange programs often also provide other things like fentanyl test strips or Narcan. Encouraging our clients not to use alone is another harm reduction strategy to prevent overdose, or call a hotline if you don't have anyone to use with. Providing education and connecting clients to Narcan resources or naloxone is a harm reduction strategy, and changing the method of taking substances. These are just a couple examples. We have a 10-hour harm reduction training you can attend to get many more ideas for how to, engage with folks who are actively using substances without shutting them or directing and really being on the same team together and wanting them to be okay. All right, next up, we've got trauma-informed care. So this is all the rage. We all know, we've been hearing about it for a while now, but what is trauma-informed care? The basic thing here is trauma-informed care shifts the focus from what's wrong with you to what happened to you. Being trauma-informed in your work supports effective engagement because, being trauma-informed supports effective engagement because we are having a more nuanced understanding of why a person does what they're doing, especially if they have a trauma history. So things that might be confusing, might be challenging, might feel difficult, might make you feel like a client, like you want to label a client as resistant or non-adherent or not, I forget there's a worse word, I can't remember. But when we want to kind of start judging and labeling, like pivoting over to being trauma-informed can really interrupt that and be better for our client. So to start understanding being trauma-informed, we shift again from what's wrong with you to what happened to you. This means understanding the impacts that trauma can have on a person's beliefs, emotions, behaviors. So if you've ever looked at the PTSD criteria in the DSM, there are a lot of things that people go through when they have been traumatized. So when a client behaves in a way that is challenging, for example, hyperarousal, someone who is in hyperarousal can be very challenging to deal with. They're doing that, they're doing this, they're doing that. It's like hard to get them to focus. If someone's hypervigilant and has a hard time, being out in different spaces with you and it's hard to engage because they're kind of, looking around everywhere, worried about every little thing. Other behaviors that can have like a traumatic root, I suppose we could say, are, you know, things like yelling or crying, things that can be really uncomfortable for us to sit with. And so when a client behaves in one of these ways, we want to consider how trauma might be impacting that behavior, which helps us to respond intentionally versus out of reacting based on our immediate emotions. And this can, when we're able to do this, clients feel more accepted, understood, and that they can count on us to support them. At the same time, being trauma-informed does not mean allowing our clients to cross our boundaries, you know, willy-nilly. We just, instead, what we're doing is when we're trauma-informed, we can establish clear and predictable boundaries. For instance, I had a client who yelled at me, and I had to tell him at some point, if you continue to yell at me, I will leave and we'll check in again next week or whenever the next time was. And this helps clients when someone has experienced trauma, it can feel really, everything can feel really chaotic. So we're kind of trying to create a container for us and our client to, where they know what to expect. They know like the consequences, they know we're going to come back. And so this can be helpful for clients who are worried if they mess up, if they engage in one of these behaviors they don't feel they have control over, are we just going to ditch them and abandon them? Instead, they might know after by using trauma-informed care that if they mess up and we need to reinforce the boundary, we'll be back again and we can keep moving forward. And that can be really helpful for other situations that feel really overwhelming for someone who has experienced trauma. All right, two more approaches and then we'll get to some other stuff. So we've got strength-based approach. This approach has been embedded in all the others we've talked about so far today from the beginning of our training. You know, I think we instill this in a lot of the content we deliver at PMHP because being strengths-focused can be used at any time as a way to enhance engagement and build a more complete picture of who your client is, gain a more nuanced understanding. When we're strengths-based, we know that our clients are the agents of change. We're respecting both their autonomy, their right to choose, make choices, and their agency, their ability to make those choices, do those things. And we're helping our clients to better appreciate their unique qualities and efforts, which if you've ever lived as a human, you may have overlooked your own before, right? Being able to help our clients really see what they're doing is really cool. Strengths aren't just about our clients' internal capabilities. These are really important and we should definitely reflect them. You know, like you're smart and kind and resourceful, all the things. But strengths also lie in a person's environment. So we want to look within them and without them. We want to, I don't know if that's, you would say that, but you want to look in and outside the person. So we're looking at their environment, their social support, their, do they have an employee? Are they employed? What's their spirituality? How are they creative? Do they engage in bartering? What are their local resources in their immediate area? You know, there's plenty we can find. You know, in this work, we're celebrating the teeniest of victories and being strengths-focused helps to do this. It helps us identify those little victories. An example could be, suppose a client has been avoiding Social Security for a couple years and finally makes it to their appointment only to leave before it's over. We might get caught up in thoughts like, they were so close, or I took so much time setting this up and now they're just leaving. They're kind of a couple different emotions. There's like disappointment or anger. But if we can shift to a strengths-focused perspective on that situation, we can immediately see that the client going into the building and sitting down with the SSA rep was a victory, right? And if we can celebrate that instead of like digging into that anger or disappointment, it can help us keep going and it helps our clients keep going as well. All right, final modality. Approach, I suppose, that is evidence-based and helps with engagement is shared decision-making. there's plenty of other, I'm sure, evidence-based tools for engagement, but this is the final, the one we're sharing today. This is a process of really like teaming up and supporting our clients when they're making decisions. And to tease out all the varying ideas that you and your client may have, you can think of these components. Okay, so we're basically teaming up with our client when they're making a decision so that they feel supported and not pressured. So we want to find out what's important to them. I'd even suggest like figuring out what's most important and starting there. We also want to think to ourselves, what are my goals for the client and what is the client's goals for themselves? Because it's nice to illuminate if we have an ulterior motive here, if we, you know, and try to pivot to the client's goals. So it's important to acknowledge that if it's coming up. So once you figure out your goals and your client's goals, you also want to look and see how different are your goals and their goals, and then figure out how to focus more on our client's goals. Then we figure out how will the client take steps towards achieving these goals, which could be labeled an objective if you do a treatment plan. And then how will you take action to achieve them? So that's the intervention in a typical treatment plan. So what this shows here is that shared decision making prioritizes the client's goals and results in action both you and the client will take to move them closer to the goal. So we're helping our clients make these decisions without coercing or directing, right? We're mindful of our own goals, but we're consciously focusing on our clients' goals. And we're figuring out what we can do and helping them figure out what they can do to get there. And so, of course, that can help engagement because the client feels listened to. And you're making small progress. So that can keep a client coming back. Okay, so that is all I have to present on for those. With that, I'll shift it back to Larry.
Thank you, Chelsea. And I will definitely continue to add on to the wonderful information just shared by Chelsea. And so first thing is, and we'll do this, you know, in a quick fashion, so it doesn't take up too much of our time. But I'm just, you know, wondering what's in your toolbox. We're welcoming you to share on the chat, in the chat, maybe a go to a particular style or something that you do often in doing the engagement process that. That you do with your clients. So please feel free to share or take yourself off on mute and identify something that is comfortable for you in within your toolbox of assertive engagement.
I will say something while folks are thinking. Would love to hear your creative approaches, right? Like talking about earlier, sports, right? When I became a social worker, I was like, I should really get into sports. It would really help engage a lot of my clients. I couldn't do it. It's not for me. But what other things, like topics or what helps you kind of get past that hump of I'm the social worker and you're the client? How do you find that common ground?
So feel free to, again, oh, here's some, perfect. Authentically acknowledging difficulties and barriers in dealing with systems that are negatively impacting my client. That's, and thank you for sharing that because yes, that's very important to acknowledge, in a very authentic fashion, the difficulties that exist, the barriers, because even those of us that have been in this field for a long time have those challenges, right? I mean, think about how many times we've had struggles in finding things like housing resources, residential treatment resources, and so on and so forth. So yes, absolutely. And as Chelsea's pointing out, just, you know, validating in many respects, definitely. So, okay. So let's move on a bit. I will.
I'm sorry to interrupt earlier in the chat. And she said she uses art activities, which I think is brilliant. I love it. Music. I've done like a phone, like the heads up phone game with clients has been super helpful in like keeping the engagement going.
Yes, thank you. Sorry I didn't see that, but you're absolutely correct here in Sonia's share that art activity can be very very helpful, very soothing, and very non-threatening in many respects of just connecting with someone. So again, thank you for sharing that, and then engaging with clients and describing their preference of activities, so I can learn from them. Actually, absolutely. The one thing that comes to mind with that, many of our clients have been in treatment before. So asking them too, what was successful in past treatment experiences and what was not, and gives us a head start. So definitely, again, icebreakers to be able to understand or to get a client in groups. And that's always very helpful. And again, since our interaction with unhoused people occur in social settings, soup kitchens, we can start a conversation by talking about music or art or food, anything that can acknowledge who they are before they were in the house. Absolutely, seeing the humanistic side of someone, and just the fact that we are all the same in many respects by way of who we are as humans, that things we like and dislike and enjoy and don't enjoy, and connecting the dots. So again, definitely some things there. I don't know if I may have missed one, but I think that here it says, when rapport building, I focus on getting to know the client. Sometimes to look at that looks like just talking about cultural events or TV shows or sports, instead of talking about heavy topics at the start. And absolutely wonderful. No need to be heavy on the clinical jargon, no need to focus on clinical outcomes. I mean, just really who you are, what's going on, and go from there. I recall, one experience I'll share real quickly before I move on, with an adolescent who was very, very low on the desired, on the desired level to be part of treatment, to say the least. My go-to with that particular client was, "Tell me where you would rather be right now, and I'll tell you where I would rather be right now." And so, since we both probably had places we would rather be, what does that look like, and what is the experience like, and why? And so, the client would, I would say, "Oh, I'd rather be at the beach. I'd rather be enjoying this food and wearing, or listening to this kind of music." Then the client would say, "I'd rather be here, this place, that place." And it would really just open up a non-threatening experience. All right, let's go on. I know we have a short amount of time to go through a lot of things like key components for engagement, so we will move right on to those as we go. So this right here is really the core of a lot of what we're talking about today. So there is several items here that I'm going to just kind of go through. Again, when we're talking about outreach, it's performing direct outreach to each client, to each person where they are geographically, not just physically. Again, when it comes to the helpfulness of it, being helpful to the client from their perspective, not from our perspective, right? Again, what is really going to be helpful for them, and how do we build off that so that everyone feels like they are gaining something? The next thing is relationships, just building relationships through empathy and really being genuine, so that the clients feel like what we're doing there is really of service for them. The next is strengths, and just identifying the client's strengths and their goals, whether it's a subtle goal or goal for the next hour or goal for that day, and be okay with it. And after that is purpose, exploring what gives this individual meaning and a guiding purpose, right? Like, why are they reaching out for support today? What is making things look, like there's a it's good timing? And the next is choices, honoring choices, regardless of what choices are, honoring choices, whether it leads us to then have a conversation briefly about harm reduction or motivational interviewing or any of the other wonderful pieces of information and techniques that Chelsea just shared. Again, just honoring that choice. And then consistent, Becoming a consistent presence, again, even if it's for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, daily, or whenever you have scheduled, just be consistent and know that it'll pay off. And then engaging clients in making informed choices about their life, you know, engaging them and sharing information by way of psychoeducation or brief information that allows for them to conceptualize what works for them by way of their own mindset. And then there's flexibility, demonstrating flexibility. If a person does not want to talk and wants to leave, remain polite. Stay, as you know, say a nice goodbye and ask them to meet again. When, you know, how long, and just maybe even simply that day say, hey, how much time do you have available today? Or you do you have any time constraints? And honoring that, you know, again, I like when someone honors my time constraints, and therefore I'd like to honor theirs as well, because, you know, they might have a lot of things that they need to get accomplished that day. And so when it comes to the next one is just, engaging, non-threatening, engaging in a non-threatening manner, just making sure that, you know, again, you're mentally prepared, you're physically prepared, and then also that you know, you're not carrying over energy from maybe another treatment session or something negative that may have happened to you recently. And so just being mindful of that. So that leads us into mindful. Being mindful and avoiding controversial topics at initial engagement. You know, if a client comes with a history of incarceration or, you know, experience that was negative, don't lead right into that. Don't categorize them. Don't label them as such of a type of person, and just be open to it. And again, respecting limits. Allowing, you know, the patient to set limits and experience control in their own interaction. Be respectful. Just a general respect is important, and ask clients. And again, next is balance. Striking a nice balance between communication and interest in our own concerning efforts is really good. Show that you are not only able to verbally and clearly speak to the client, but also listen just as effectively. And that really helps to build the trust. Next is being honest. Communicate your role very clearly. Be honest what you can and cannot offer with the client so that there's no misunderstanding. And then lastly, it's identifying concern. Responding to the client's medical issues as a vehicle of engagement would be helpful if there is other areas, not just in medical, but knowing that we are just as concerned that they get the support needed for there. So, again, Chelsea has done a wonderful job of adding our training slide information, MI, and all the other wonderful things. So please access those. So again, keeping in mind, just thinking outside the box is going to be the emphasis, and will make you really individualize some support for someone when it's uniquely and genuinely, organically set for them. One can feel that. So as talking about, you know, these approaches of outside the box thinking of just, you know, why are they living here in this spot, in this particular area? What is it about this geographic area? And be respectful of it, regardless of if you feel comfortable there or don't think it's the place you would be. Just understand that that's their comfort space, and that's okay. The next is, what is important to them in their surroundings? Maybe they're there because of proximity to their children, to a family, you know, maybe even to the fact that they have access to food around there. Whatever the case may be okay with it. Are they near any resources? And again, your definition of resource may not be theirs. Their resource may be to access drugs because that's what they're currently needing. And if that's their level of resource, then let's be mindful that that is something that they have chosen to make a priority. Again, next is, what community are they part of currently? And when we talk about community, oftentimes, like when I talk about the word culture, let's not think about ethnic community or geographic, general traditional definitions of what community or culture is. When we talk about community is the belonging of an entity or of a group that has a set of rules that may not be similar to ours, whether that is gang affiliation, whether that is a group of folks that have chosen to live together in an encampment, whatever the case may be. Honor that and ask them about that community experience. What role do they play in that community, and how important from a 1 to a 5 that community is for them? And do they feel safe there? Do you feel safe within that community? What is your role again? And then lastly, how do they maintain their quality of life, right? Things like food, resources, safety, and how does that all come to play within their own ecosystem that they've built around them? So, and as we look at, the next slide here is just really kind of going through this process of ask, explore, offer, identify, and consider. Again, ask if the client would be okay if you bring them food. Some, don't assume that just because someone is living homeless that they haven't eaten. The fact is that there might be resources that we may not be aware of. And so being polite about that and asking, hey, I do have access to the following next time we meet, and then bring it up. Then explore if there is a meeting location of preference. You may be meeting in a place where they no longer want to be or enjoy being. So then offer a possibility of a meeting reminder. If they have access to a phone or some technology, can I text you? Can I prompt you? Can I remind you so that we meet at the same time? I would really not want to, miss an appointment with you. So something to keep in mind. And then identify, if unhoused, identify geographic areas of frequency. This is extremely important. Oftentimes I would train my teams in this fashion to always ask upon assessing or meeting, what is your geographic surrounding areas of comfort by way of maybe 2 to 3 areas that you really enjoy, so that we are able to then look for a client in another space in the event they're not at the plan A spot. And then consider, if unhoused, does a client have access to a phone or charger? And if so, consider something like a solar charger to keep those conversation components going. And again, here are now just some very practical stuff. I will go through these really quickly. For those of you that are very familiar with, the FSP budgeting stuff, just remember that you might have access to flex funds, some of you more than others, to utilize as a secondary tool by way of engaging, by way of providing a supportive element that a client may be missing during engagement. So keep that in mind. Again, when it comes to flex funds, know that there is parameters built in by DMH. And so, there's things that can be appropriately purchased and some not. Some things that are helpful by way of that, but do not ever purchase by way of incentivizing a client, like, hey, if you meet with me, I'm going to give you this, because that is not part of that process of flex funds. It's really as a supportive element. So keep that in mind. And our next slide here is just an example of allowable expenses. And so as you look at allowable expenses, even before, and I'm sure all of you have access to this throughout through your agency, ask for this form here, and or ask your supervisor, director, or any entity of such as to what is allowable as an expense and what is not, to make sure you're doing things in accordance to your contractual obligations. And then just a few documentation reminders that are definitely going to be helpful to you long-term. Next slide, we'll go to the first one, which is, completing a COS note when a client is not open in the system yet or not part of the assessment process yet. Continue to update notes in SRTS. When ready, then conduct the assessment. Provide often consultations with your team. Incorporate case presentations as needed, so everyone on the team is aware of all and every changing aspect of the client's treatment. And please remember to do OMAs, because this will not only help you remind your team of benchmarks, but now it's tied into incentives that are even very more important to the fiscal side of your agency. I will hand it over back to Chelsea so that she can kind of close us off for this wonderful Friday. And then just want to say thank you for all of you who have decided to join today and add to your toolbox by way of assertive engagement techniques.
Yes, thank you everyone for being here today. Thanks for your contribution in the chat, your engagement there. I almost get goosebumps when I hear people talk about their like creative approaches to engagement. So thank you for sharing those. Hope you, and I'm sure I'm not the only inspired one. So thanks for supporting each other. We have a couple of ongoing things you might be interested in. We've got an LA County field-based case manager learning exchange that happens every other Tuesday. Our next session is next Tuesday. And it's really a great place to come if you have client like resource questions that you want to ask other providers about throughout LA County. And then we have a Recess Wednesday self-care break. It's just a half hour. We do things like meditation, chair yoga, expressive arts, journaling, music. We do all kinds of stuff. It's just a little break if you want to schedule something in to your workday every other week. And then what else have we got in here? We've got our references. It's great to hear from you and great to think about how clients in LA County get to benefit from engaging with you all. So take good care, and we'll hope to see you at the next one.